This is Radio Freethinker, episode 104.
Mandry, you realize that in addition to fluoridating water, where there are studies underway to fluoridate salt, flour, fruit juices, soup, sugar, milk, ice cream, Mandry, children's ice cream.
Oh, you know when fluoridation first began?
No, I don't yet.
1946. 1946, Mandrake. How does that coincide with your post-war commie conspiracy? It's incredibly obvious, isn't it? A foreign substance is introduced into our precious bodily fluids without the knowledge of the individual. Certainly without any choice. That's the way a hardcore commie works.
Jack, listen, tell me, Jack, when did you first develop this theory?
Well, I first became aware of it, Mandrake, during the physical act of love. Huh. Yes, a profound sense of fatigue, feeling of emptiness followed. Mm-hmm. Luckily, I was able to interpret these feelings correctly. Loss of essence. Yeah. I can assure you it has not recurred, Mandrake. Women sense my power, and they seek the life essence. I do not avoid women, Mandrake.
Yeah.
But I do deny them my essence.
Yes.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher with his bodily fluids intact.
Intact. That was a clip from Dr. Strangelove, one of the funniest and most biting satires of, well, not our time, but a time before that.
Yes, disturbing in some ways, too, you know. But why would we be playing that at the beginning of the show?
Well, you know, we're going to be talking a little bit later about fluoridation and also politics as well. So it fits in nicely with the theme of the show. And what a great show we have lined up today on Radio Free Thinker. We'll be discussing the latest in criminal charges against the Pope, a new study on cell phone radiation, fluoride in Calgary's water, and questions you can ask politicians in the upcoming election. I had a very interesting week, actually. I had a very interesting skeptical experience this week.
Really?
Yeah, I did, yes.
Wow. What happened?
Well, you see, I encountered some long-standing rumors about a video game that I really like called The Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time, which was released in 1998, so it's old. Supposedly, one of these levels in the game features a Muslim chant in the background music. Now, the myth goes that this angered the Muslim community so much that they altered the game after its release and removed those chants. Now, perhaps not being the best skeptic, I just assumed such rumors were true. My copy of the game did include the so-called, you know, chants, but I did know people who had the copy of a game that didn't have the chants. So I figured, okay, well, it's, you know, that's kind of reasonable. Turns out, though, I was wrong. The chanting was indeed removed, but it was not after the game was released. A group of very dedicated gaming sleuths figured out that the chanting appears on two versions of the game, but not any others. And they figured this out by accessing the debug menu in the game and checking its version and when it was completed. And it turns out that the chanting was removed prior to any of the versions being released anywhere in the world. So, ergo, they could have indeed received complaints about the chanting, but that wouldn't have been the reason for the change, since the changes occurred before the game was released.
Okay, no. Now, being a better skeptic, maybe? So, you just told me that your version of the game has the chant in it, but mm-hmm. then you've just said that your version can't because they never actually released
version. They did. They released both versions at the same time. So, one version had the chants. One version, well, two versions have the chance, and then every other version after that didn't have the chance.
You just said when they went back through their log that there was some versioning prior to release. You just said it.
No. There were versions before the release that had the chance and some that didn't, but they were released at the same time.
So there are versions before the release that was released. So they mean like beta copies?
No. There was. So first, there were no games.
Right.
Then they made the games, and then they released them. But the two, when they released them, there were different versions. They were released at the same time. Yep. Some had the chance, some didn't.
Okay.
But they came out at the exact same time. So it wasn't like one came out, they got complaints, and then changed it for a future release.
Okay. When was this released again?
1998.
So this would have been before 9/11 and all the true fear about Muslims will kill you sort of thing. So,
well, it wasn't so much, from what I understand, complaints about the Muslim chants. They were complaints from the Islamic community saying, you can't use our chants in your video game. Now, I've heard the chants, and it's very hard to determine if that is, in fact, a Muslim chant. It sounds vaguely Arabic, but it could just be, you know, pareidolia of some kind seeping into it.
I think you're missing the bigger story here. I think we may have found the true cause for the 9/11 attacks. Maybe it was this video game that actually inspired the massive uprising against the United States. And that although the towers are the economic heart images of the United States, they also represented images in this game.
Shouldn't they have attacked Japan then?
Oh. I'm going to go special pleading on this.
Okay.
And say that, yes, but it was financed by American capital. Which brings us back to the Twin Towers. You see, you can never kill a good conspiracy. But, you know, on this topic, actually, there was something I was listening to on Quirks and Quarks about games in general that I thought was quite interesting and will provide good support for those people who love to play games. They had an author on there who had done some studies into the effects of gaming, and I must admit her name escapes me right now. But she had pointed out that everyone should play about 7 hours of games a week, and that apparently that this year provided a positive stressor in one's life, that there's sort of bad pressure and that there's good pressure, and that by playing about 7 hours of games a week, that it actually helped your psychic health and your body's ability to do what it does by doing this. Although she also pointed out that although 7 hours was good, by the time you start hitting 21 hours a week, there's no longer any kind of a benefit. And by 28, you're actually starting to have negative effects by, you know, anxiety and all that.
What is this notion, though, of positive stress?
Well, the way she worked at it is that, you know, like if you're trying to achieve a goal and you can achieve it, that actually makes you feel good, that you feel like you've done an accomplishment. In fact, one of the things I really loved about her description of what a game is, she said that the game is, and I'm roughly paraphrasing here, is the unnecessary placement of obstacles in one's path. So the example she used, she said golf. If you look at the game of golf, right, what's the object of golf? Well, taking a little ball and putting it into one hole. Well, that's easy. To pick a ball up, you put it into the hole, it's done. But no, we don't want the easy. We want to put in some unnecessary obstacles in order to make the game more enjoyable. And then you got to say, well, what does it mean enjoyable? Well, this is where this positive stress is, that you got it. So we put the hole, you know, hundreds of feet away. We have to use a stick to hit it with. Anyone who wants to know exactly how stupid golf can be, you should just look up Robin Williams in golf, and there's a great skit of him doing it online, and it's hilarious. But it points out that there's this the idea that games, it's universal. Almost every culture we've ever discovered has some form of gaming in it. And again, she says that there's this idea of positive stress, and that we actually don't play enough games on average in our society, and we should actually try and play about an hour a day. Right? And even some of those games can be informative games. They were talking about two scientifically related games. One was Fold It, and one was Eterna. And Fold It was trying to fold proteins. And if you could fold a protein in the right way, it had more points. But they were also using this to help develop new drugs. And Eterna is a similar game, but it deals with RNA. And you've got to construct an RNA molecule that will last a long time, and if yours does very, very well, there are scientists who will actually create this molecule and see how useful it is. In fact, the Folded one, when the scientists finally released their paper, they cited as contributing authors all the people who had played the game, because they were all part of the whole stuff.
Cool. Well, so what else is driving your personal skepticism, Don?
Well, you know, our email has been getting a little dusty lately, so I thought maybe I just mentioned some things that get me thinking. You know, as a good skeptic, you should always go out and just ask questions and say, even if it's dogma, you know, by our own standards, we should ask it. Mm-hmm. So recently, unless you've been put your head in the sand, you may have noticed there's been a little bit of kerfuffle in the Middle East. And notably in Libya, and prior to that, Egypt, a number of Canadians who were complaining that the Canadian government hadn't been doing enough to rescue Canadian citizens who happened to be in the country. And that just got me to think. I mean, how much responsibility does the Canadian government have to essentially protect or to help citizens who are out of state? I mean, if you're a tourist and you're in another country, haven't you in some way taken on the responsibility of getting your own butt home, you know, even in a state of emergency? I'm not coming up with any great answers here, it's not intended to, but what do you think? Do you think the Canadian government has a moral obligation to help its citizens in this particular incident to help out? Or is it, if you could afford the flight to see Tripoli, you should be able to afford a flight out of it, even the instance of danger?
Well, I mean, maybe even along the same lines is the notion of seeking clemency for citizens on death row in another country. If you are a citizen of Canada and you commit a crime in China, should the government of Canada intervene to have you extradited back to Canada? Or do you now are you now a subject of the law of the land that you're currently in?
Exactly. I mean, how would we feel if, you know, someone had committed a crime in Canada and suddenly that foreign nation state came in here and said, well, listen, we know you have your own local laws and regulations, but we don't think they should apply to our citizens, and they get squirreled away for those kind of reasons.
Exactly.
You know? On a related note, and I like doing things in three, so I'm going to make up a second of the three, and it's really, really related. And in an odd way, I feel so sorry for the United States. I rarely feel sorry for the United States for some things, but right now, they're in a no-win situation. As, again, people know, Libya is descending into civil war. And to the point where the Libyan leader, Muammar Gaddafi, has been using airplanes to shoot at his own citizens. Now, for those of us in the rest of the world, we see this as morally reprehensible. But should we intervene? I mean, on the one hand, you know, if we do intervene, then it's like, oh, well, there's the United States, because they're the ones most likely to do it, you know, meddling in the affairs of other nations. And yet, if they don't do it, it's like, well, I thought you believed in democracy. Didn't you invade Iraq and all that to restore peace and all that? And here you're sitting back letting citizens get slaughtered. I mean, it really seems to be almost a no-win situation.
A catch-22, if you will.
Yes, actually. That'd be a good movie. But no, so that was another thing I was thinking of, you know, that what do you guys think about the whole idea? I mean, is there a point when one nation should invade another nation in order to protect the basic civil liberties, or not even the liberties, the life and limb of local citizens? Or are local citizens, like are Libyans, the property of the nation of Libya, and therefore they get to do whatever they want to them? Again, no answers, just throwing it out there for a question. Now for the easy one. As people may know, I was born in Manitoba, so every so often Manitoba news comes to my my desktop. A judge in Manitoba currently is under fire for a recent ruling where he stated that the rape victim, and she was acknowledged as a victim, for the man involved was convicted, so she was a victim, but that she dressed provocatively and that, quote-unquote, sex was in the air and it was inviting circumstances. Therefore, his sentence was to the guy who committed the rape, right? And again, it was deemed a rape. But it was only a 2-year conditional sentence, and his name was placed on a sex offender's registry. Okay, so now, first of all, I agree, no means no. And at any point, no is no. So consent, you know, consent can be withdrawn. But it did lead me to just ask the question that, is there a certain point when there is what was the term you were using before?
Diminished intent.
Diminished intent, or again, a certain point where there's a responsibility of one person to sort of mitigate risks involved, right? And I mean, in this particular case, if you read the details, it's not applicable in this case. It was clearly not one that I think he really ruled perfectly on. But there is a point. I mean, for example, if I sit there and I leave $50 cash on a park bench and someone takes it, well, they still committed theft, right? It wasn't their money, and they took it. But there is a certain point when, you know, I have to say, well, why did you leave the $50 out there? You know, it was, there's a point where I should have a certain amount of freedom to do what I want, but there's a certain point where maybe, you know, there is a responsibility on your end, you know?
Sure. I mean, you could make the argument that it's not so much a question of responsibility or freedom, it's more of a question of common sense. And that doesn't necessarily make any criminal action less bad. It just means that the person in question didn't exercise due diligence in either protecting their property or themselves.
Well, and you know, in theft, again, because I was just using that as a parallel, not saying that theft is in any way equivalent to rape or anything like that, but in rape, if someone honestly believed that, you know, they weren't stealing something, that actually in our legal system is deemed to be a excuse for not deeming it as theft. Now, does this apply in any way to the cases of sexual assault? I'm not saying it does. I'm just saying, even if we think something is, there is no questions to be asked, we should still ask the questions just to reaffirm whatever beliefs we currently hold. Because as good skeptics, we don't want to fall into the pit of dogma. Mm-hmm. You know, and again, I'm not saying one way or the other at this particular point, but I'd love to hear from our listeners at radio.freethinker@gmail.com and tell us, what do you think about these thought-provoking questions?
I would love to hear what they think about these questions. Why don't we go to a commercial break, and we'll be back with more on Radio Freethinker.
Don't you put it in your mouth. Don't you put it in your mouth. Don't you stuff it in your face. Don't stuff it in your face. Though it might look good to eat. Though it might look good to eat. And it might look good to taste. And it might look good to taste. You could get sick. Ick. Real quick. Ick. Real sick. Real.
CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. Don't put it in your mouth. Put it in your ear.
Ick! Don't you put it in your mouth. Uh-uh. Till you ask someone you love. That's right, sis. If it's okay to eat. If it's okay to eat like a muffin.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver.
Your Friends of CITR card will get you discounts on Main Street at Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear,
Woo Vintage,
The Kiss Store, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, The Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl,
Flaming Angels Boutique,
and the Wallflower Modern Diner.
Pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or visit us online at citr.ca.
Welcome back to Radio Freethinker here on CITR. So last week, I blogged about this new development in which the Pope has been charged with crimes against humanity by two German lawyers. Let me give you a quote here from the paper that I saw this in, the Irish Times. Christian Saylor and Gert Jakob Herzl, based at, I'm not going to pronounce that properly, this German town in the Pope's home state of Bavaria last week submitted a 16,500-word document to the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court at The Hague, Dr. Luis Moreno Ocampo. So, specifically mentioned in the lawsuit is that Pope Benedict leads and is responsible for the preservation and leadership of a worldwide totalitarian regime of coercion which subjugates its members with terrifying and health-endangering threats. So, what health-endangering threats do they mean? The article mentions forbidding condom use, even for the purpose of preventing HIV/AIDS infection. The article also mentions the creation of a worldwide conspiracy to cover up the sexual abuse of minors. Also listed is the Catholic Church inducts members through a compulsory act, meaning baptism. If you're an infant, you can't refuse a baptism. The document claims that this act is irreversible and enforced by excommunication. So you can read the entire 16,500-word document online. We have a link to it on my blog post. And the case has been submitted to the International Criminal Court, or the ICC, at The Hague. However, this is no guarantee that the court will accept the case or even pursue any of the charges. When I wrote my initial blog post, I checked the official website of the Vatican and the Holy See, and so far nothing has been posted about these charges. I also checked the website of the ICC and found nothing. They do publish weekly reports on the ICC, and they may have published it since I last checked, but you'll have to go look that up at some point, maybe next week. So the document that they filed is officially listed under Article 7 of the ICC Rome Statute, which refers to crimes against humanity. And under this document, these offenses include such things as murder, extermination, enslavement, deportation or forced transfer of population, imprisonment or severe deprivation of physical liberty, and violence or fundamental rules of international law, torture, rape, sexual slavery, and forced prostitution, other forms of sexual violence, persecution against any identifiable group or collective on political, racial, national, ethnic, etc. levels. Let's see, enforcement, enforced disappearance of persons, so that's like making someone disappear, the crime of apartheid, other inhumane acts of similar character, intentionally causing great suffering or serious injury to body or mental or physical health.
Well, one of the good ones, sorry, just because I think it'll be important, forced pregnancy is one of the ones that's in there, too.
Under the sexual violence.
Yep.
There. So, I mean, it sounds like you could fit pretty easily many of the allegations that the lawyers are placing at Pope Benedict within this category. Now, there's a few that I'm not quite sure about. The one that kind of caught my eye was the notion of compulsory membership that's backed up with the threat of excommunication. And I mean, that of course is true. It is compulsory. If you're an infant, you can't refuse it. And if you believe in church doctrine, excommunication is a very bad thing. However, based on what we know about the universe, and I assume the nature of a court, I have trouble understanding if this could be proved in a court of law that such a thing is a reality. Is the threat of excommunication even credible to be considered a threat?
I think there's one thing, actually. I was talking to a friend of mine the other day about the game Left Behind. Right, and it was supposed to be nonviolent because you don't go around and you don't shoot anyone, you just condemn them to hell. And then I sat back and I thought, well, wait a minute. Now, at least if you believed in hell, right? And I think this is where maybe it would play into it. Hell is not a very nice place. I mean, tortured for eternity, burning alive. I mean, a lot of pain. Now, even if we accept the fact that, you know, we're good atheists, so we know, oh, you're stupid, you don't believe in it. But if the person believes in it, the social and mental anguish that would cause that person to live under with the idea that whenever I die, this is going to await me. Mm-hmm. I mean, isn't that sort of a form of psychological torture or pain? So
it could possibly be. I mean, I was sort of thinking about this, and suppose I threaten someone with a magic curse. Would that be grounds for a lawsuit? I mean, if they believed in magic curses, it would have probably a psychological effect on them. But if I just told someone, you know, the average person, they'd probably just laugh at me. You know, if I told someone, watch out, or my unicorn's going to get you, is that on the same level as saying, you know, watch out, or my pit bull's going to get you? One of them is real, one of them is a fictional animal. So I don't know. Is that something you can build a criminal case around? I'm not sure. I'm not a lawyer. I have no legal experience or anything like this, so perhaps they can make the case on the grounds of psychological suffering. We'll have to see. Now, the other big question that I think a lot of people have is, well, can charges even be laid on the Pope, who is the head of state of the Vatican and the Holy See? Well, for this, I checked out the document, and I looked up, you know, what do they say about this? And I'm going to read you a quote from the document itself. So, according to Article 27 of the ICC statute, all persons are subject to the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court, regardless of their official capacity. In particular, official capacity as a head of state or government shall in no case exempt a person from criminal responsibility under this statute. Immunities which may attach to the official capacity of a person, whether under national or international law, shall not bar the court from exercising its jurisdiction over such a person. So the lawmakers have a case here that they think makes it possible to try the Pope, and that he can't hide behind, I'm the head of a state, I have immunity, et cetera, et cetera.
You know, and actually this goes even further, because, I mean, there's actually sort of precedent for this, right? I mean, the president of Sudan has been charged.
That's right.
President of Ivory Coast was charged, although they actually got him after he was kicked out of office. And the same thing with Milosevic and those in Serbia, although, again, he was also done afterwards. But so maybe you have to be black in order to be charged while head of state. So this could be a racist thing.
Well, you know, that wouldn't be the first person to make that argument. You know, I don't know. I don't know if these charges are going to stick or not. It's difficult to see. The Pope has a lot of power and authority. There's no telling how he could try to weasel his way out of this. But even if they don't get him, I still think this is a very good thing. It sort of breaks the spell, to quote Daniel Dennett. The reality of the situation is the Pope is powerful. It's unlikely that the first attempt to get him will succeed. It might take several tries, but those additional tries afterwards are going to be more potent if people sort of stop thinking of the Pope as sort of a magical God's representative on Earth who's unquestionable. You got to sort of desensitize people to the notion that the Pope is a human being and is subject to human laws, and he doesn't have this get-out-of-jail-free card because, you know, he wears a funny hat.
And again, you know, this goes on to bring in topical things. A number of the dictators in the Middle East, you know, everyone said, well, they've been here for like 20, 30, 40 years. They're always going to be here. There's no point even trying. But, you know, you have one or two people who sort of started, and then it grew and it grew, and eventually justice will probably be done, at least in most of the areas. Definitely been done in some areas. So maybe justice will be brought to the Pope.
We'll have to keep a close eye on this. Let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Freethinker.
Are you interested in radio, but not quite sure how to get involved? CITR is the place for you. We are a volunteer-driven campus and community radio station with a variety of volunteer opportunities. Want to become an on-air programmer? Learn about promotions? Maybe become a news or arts reporter? Come learn about all the ways you can become involved at CITR. Volunteer orientations are held on the first Monday of every month at 6:30 p.m. If the first Monday falls on a statutory holiday, the orientation moves to the second Monday. Visit citr.ca for more information.
And we're back on Radio Freethinker.
Yes.
What's going on?
We're going to get to scoop the SGU again. I know it.
I love this study. Scooping them.
I found this study that I almost guarantee will be on the SGU this week. There apparently was a cell phone study done that showed that cell phone radiation affected the brain. All those people who've been complaining were right. Well, not really. And a study recently published by Dr. Nora Volkow et al. In the Journal of American Medical Associations, also referred to as JAMA, titled The Effect of Cell Phone Radio Frequency Signal Exposure on Brain Glucose Metabolism. Yes, that's what an article sounds like in these magazines.
I see.
It shows that cell phone use can increase brain metabolism. Now, the study itself had the subjects place on their left and right side a cell phone. Test subjects were exposed, in quotes, to the cell phones for 30 minutes. Then they were injected with fluorodexoxyglucose, a radioactive tracer chemical, and then were further exposed for another 20 minutes. Then a PET scan, it was scanned.
Sure.
Was made. For all of them, the left phones were inactive through the whole study. In some of the subjects, the right cell phone was inactive. In others, the phones were active, but they were muted. So the results of this test showed that the whole brain metabolism, as in the brain working overall, there was no difference between the on and off condition, but that metabolism in the regions closest to the antenna were significantly higher than when on than when off. Now, the study's conclusion, in healthy participants compared to those with no exposure, 50-minute cell phone exposure was associated with increased brain glucose metabolism in regions closest to the antenna. This finding is of unknown clinical significance. It's an important little bit she put at the end. If you hear her on, again, I believe it was Quirks and Quarks that I was listening to, She goes quite out to elicit what this does and does not say. So the study does not identify the mechanism for increased activity. It was pointed out by one of the other people that were on this show doing it that everything can increase the brain metabolism. Opening your eyes increases brain metabolism. Temperature changes can increase your metabolism.
Right.
The study did not claim that the activity was a positive or negative thing. It did not identify the minimum time necessary for these changes in metabolism. 50 minutes is a pretty long phone call for most people.
Yeah.
It did not identify how long the effects lasted. Again, this was like one snapshot. It did not show any health effects, either positive or negative. And the study was only of 47 healthy people. So really a very, very small study.
I remember seeing this article pop up on a few websites. And the one thing that I noticed right away was sort of what you mentioned. There was no claim that the activity was positive or negative. The way it actually I sort of took it was that it was sort of like stimulating parts of the brain.
Yeah, actually, one of the things that the Dr. Volkov mentioned is that, you know, that her study just basically showed that there was some effects, but that further study would be needed, and in fact that there's actually a lot of therapeutic uses that could be put to this, right? Because again, increasing brain metabolism, getting the blood flowing in the brain, especially in things like stroke victims, is actually a very positive thing to be done.
Sure,
right?
Yeah, definitely.
And she also wanted, because she knew when she was doing this that there was going to be a hornet's nest about, oh no, that explains why everyone's dying. She said that she wanted to reiterate that the claims that cell phones were dangerous seems unfounded due to the lack of correlative evidence of increased health risks in the last couple of decades. She said, well, if there really were that much danger, the number of people who use cell phones and the degree that they use cell phones, we'd all be keeling over dead if there was actually anything. So she was really making sure that she wanted to distance herself from the fear mongers, but still pointing out that, you know, even if it's still dogma to assume there is no effect and that there is science to be done just to say, hey, what is actually happening?
Right. Well, speaking of getting the blood moving in the brain, and I guess getting fluids moving in other parts of our body as well. What's this I hear about fluoride?
Well, you know, apparently in 1946 or thereabouts, the communists integrated the United States, and they did it through three mechanisms, only two of which I can remember. One was the polio vaccine, the other was the fluoridation of the water, which would somehow turn you communist. And I guess Calgary, at long last, has bought into that particular story. Calgary City Council voted 10-3 to remove fluoride from the city's drinking water. Now, there are many ways that they could have handled this debate, and some of them I don't think would have been really that pertinent to our show. If they had said, you know, it costs the city roughly $750,000 a year to fluoridate the water, and apparently there's upcoming maintenance and upgrades to the system that were going to cost $6 million. City Council could have said, well, listen, you know, we just can't afford it, and that sort of would have been the end of it as far as we would have been concerned, I think. In fact, some councillors had suggested that they put off this decision to a panel of experts from the University of Calgary to get a, you know, is it cost-benefit analysis to what's been done. But this was rejected by the councillors because the councillors wanted to show leadership. So, yes, the best way to show leadership is to not know what you're talking about and blindly lead someone over a cliff. Now, how far this cliff is, we're not quite sure. The reasons, though, that the councillors stated that they wanted to do it was based on health concerns and freedom of choice. Now, those people who are in favor of fluoridating water point out that fluoride has a proven record of preventing tooth decay, especially in vulnerable groups such as the poor, the children, and the elderly, who quite often can't afford proper dental care, can't afford proper things like toothpaste, becomes a bit of a luxury. Of course, opponents to it point out the safety of fluoride in drinking, that there may be health risks to drinking it in water, and that it should be up to the individuals to decide whether or not they get this added or put in.
So, in doing some research on this, I kind of assumed that the evidence was very clearly in the favor of using fluoride. But then I did a bit more research and I thought, oh, wow, maybe the jury's kind of out on this. What is the conclusion that we can draw on fluoride? Is it beneficial or is it not beneficial? What does the science say?
Well, first of all, I guess fluoride has been added to the water to help tooth decay since the 40s, as the clip we played to begin with. So, I mean, there is a long history of having it in our water.
Health Canada did a study, and it pointed out, you know, that there are some minor risks to things like skeletal fluorosis that can occur, right? Mm-hmm. But that's only if you take 10 milligrams a day after 10 years, which would mean if you get it from water, you'd be drinking 15 liters of water a day, which normal people don't
drink that much water.
In fact, the biggest health risk that has come out from the science part of it is what they call mild dental fluorosis, which is a slight discoloration of the teeth. And that accounted for 98.5% of the cases of fluoridosis in North America, of which a third of those were questionable whether they even counted as that. And that's only not even to mention that 63% of people didn't have anything at all. So it seemed to be very small. Health Canada report also pointed out that the weight of evidence does not support any link between the exposure of fluoride and increase of cancer or IQ, which again has been some of the claims been thrown at it. It also published that levels twice the current level had no adverse health effects regarding immunotoxicity, reproductive development, genotoxicity, or neurotoxicity, i.e. there's no toxicity in the amounts that we tend to drink.
So there's no way that that's going to work your way into you and mess with your bodily fluids?
Well, the one area where they said there could be some risk, or not risk, some concern, is with infants, right? Because infants, relative to their body size, would actually be taking in a more significant amount. But they pointed out that the biggest source of fluoride for infants comes through reconstituted formula. And that because of that, there's actually a dramatically reduced amount of bioavailable fluoride in that, as opposed to if they drank it from pure water. So, and bioavailable is just a fancy word for saying something your body can actually absorb, right? So the opponents, of course, only point out that fluoride is a toxin and that we are poisoning our children. I mean, the research that I did really stopped there. And when they say, well, what do you mean by, you know, it's a poison? Well, they point out to, again, dental fluorosis and skeletal fluorosis, which are genuine things, but have it an almost insignificant amount of effect on the population in general. And that if you really were talking about toxins, I mean, technically salt is a toxin. In fact, water is a toxin. There have been a number of cases where people have literally drunk themselves to death. Notably, Andy Warhol, apparently after a gallbladder operation, was overhydrated and that caused his death. So I mean, is fluoride a toxin? Yes, but almost everything in our society.
Well, they're basically committing the naturalistic fallacy there.
Yeah,
sort of.
Well, and the funny thing is, I mean, of the targets to go for, if the opponents truly thought that fluoride was toxic, they shouldn't be working so much at the water supply. They should be putting their efforts into banning or at least reducing the amounts of fluoride that's found in toothpaste, which have concentrations of 1,000 to 5,000 times greater than that what you find in water. Now, so that was sort of a brief rundown of the scientific evidence, but you did bring up one thing that I did want to mention, that the evidence for fluoride being helpful as far as preventing tooth decay, there have been a number of studies that have shown it to be, but not as conclusive as I would like it to be, right? Mm-hmm. So again, it's not one of those things where should children drink milk for calcium, right, where there's almost overwhelming evidence for that, right? So there is a number of studies who show that fluoride is good. It does help tooth decay, and there's been a lot of history of it. But I was actually surprised to find out that Vancouver doesn't fluoridate its water. There are a number of cities in the world who don't fluoridate their water. And I couldn't find any cross-correlative studies to show what the effects were on, let's say, Calgary's tooth decay issues versus Vancouver's tooth decay issues. So that leads me into the other point that they have on, is that they claim that people don't have a choice, right? I mean, if you want water, you can have water. One, this is a bit spiritless because a lot of people are drinking bottled water these days, which I think is a bad thing, so I'm not promoting it as an option, but I mean, still, that is one way you could get around this. But it also fails in the fact that the people who are most affected are children, and children don't get to vote. So they get forced either way into doing this. The second is the idea of informed consent. So, again, there are some things that could be brought up about this. I mean, and most of it being it's a waste of money, right? You could honestly make that claim, and it's debatable, but you could make that claim. But because the poisoning of the well, which we talked about in a argument clinic episode earlier, that people don't have an informed consent. They don't really know the real risks or benefits involved because of all this fear-mongering going around it, right? So, and the other part that comes into it, too, is the idea of equality. Now, some Calgary councillors did recommend looking into, sometime in the future, possible efforts to ensure people like the homeless and impoverished could be helped to purchase fluoride-based toothpaste, maybe. Now, one, I think that in the long run would be a bit more expensive because, again, you're promoting, you know, a commercial product. But it does point out the fact that there are vulnerable people in our society who will be disproportionately affected by this if you go with the free choice argument. I don't know. I looked at this debate, and I was hoping when I first got into it, oh, it'll be cut and dry. We've got the nuts on the one side and the power of reason on the other. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't quite as clear-cut as I thought. And again, if their argument was strictly based on the idea of cost-benefit analysis, which they should have left to a panel of experts who, being experts, would know much better than some yahoo got elected to city council, then I would say, you know, this probably wouldn't have even crossed my radar at all.
Right. You know, I remember being at the dentist once, and my dentist remarked that you see a lot more cavities in kids from Vancouver and the Vancouver area than you do in Toronto. And he said it's because of the fluoride in the water. Mm. So, I mean, that's just his opinion. I don't know if he has any evidence to back it up. He's a dentist, but, again, that's anecdotal evidence at best. So, you know, it is weird because I kind of thought, too, you're going to see clear-cut evidence on one side, fluoride works, and then the loonies on the other side saying, oh, no, communist plot, et cetera, et cetera. Didn't really come across that way, though.
No, and I don't know. I think part of it, again, doing some of the research, I came across some, 1940s CBC informative documentary sort of thing about we need to go and fluoridate, and it's a good thing, you know, country pulling together, let's be modern. And I suspect, actually, in the beginning that a lot of this was dogmatic on the pro-fluoride side, that it was good. End of discussion, let's just go forward and do this, right? And and I think because of that in the initial phase, there hasn't been as much follow-up science that should be there, with the exception, again, a number of people who've done things to show that the people who are claiming fluoride will kill you just isn't really a valid argument.
Well, let's go to a commercial break, and when we come back, we'll discuss questions to ask politicians. Perhaps fluoride will be a question you should ask a politician. Stay tuned.
The state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now, hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a cry. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. But I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Bread and Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver. CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite! Yes!
Hi, I'm Jeremy McElroy, your AMS president. Next week, March 7th to the 11th, the AMS, your student society, is holding a referendum to renew the UPass, fix our fees, and fix our bylaws. By voting yes, you'll be supporting the continuation of the UPass program, which will remain affordable at a $30 rate. You'll also be supporting a new fee structure that will allow your AMS to provide better services, support clubs, and hold awesome events. Starting next week, March 7th to the 11th, vote yes in the AMS referendum and help us enhance student life. Visit www.ams.ubc.ca for more details.
Yes!
And we're back on Radio Freethinker. So, questions for politics.
Well, as people may or may not know, there is a significant chance that in the upcoming year we may have one or two elections, one federal, one provincial, and we're definitely going to have a municipal election, I believe, in November of this year. So the idea of coming up with some questions to ask politicians, actually, I'd like to eventually format this into sort of a survey that you send out to the various candidates and get the responses back, which is a common thing that's done in a lot of, at least, American context. Not so much
the science debate was, I think, the example during the previous presidential election.
Yeah. So that sort of thing. So I broke down some questions, and I'm going to kind of roughly ask Ethan them, and he'll probably say yes, no, and we'll see whether these are good or not. But the big thing about these, you're going to hear a few that I'm going to mention. We're going to put these up on our blog. But again, think about what kind of questions you think would be good to ask a politician. And a lot of these should be, you know, do you agree strongly or disagree strongly or somewhere in between? And some of them can be a little leading, but the idea is not to be too one-sided, because you want to get the true response from the candidate. I mean, I'd much rather them give me an honest response and it be negative than to them to tell me what I think I want to hear, because politicians, as we know, have a habit of telling you what you want to hear.
Absolutely.
So, in the idea of personal beliefs, Ethan, do you believe Canada is a religious nation?
Do I believe Canada is a religious nation, did you say?
Yes.
No, I don't.
Oh, good. Do you believe that a good politician should use their spiritual knowledge in making informed decisions, irrespective of what the science might say?
No.
That's a good one. Would you sooner resign from office than go against your religious beliefs or secular beliefs?
So could you give me a bit of context?
Well, I guess to apply it to you,
okay. Right?
Would you rather resign office than provide funding to religious schools if you were part of the government?
That's an interesting one. I guess on a principled level, I would say I would resign rather than do that. Maybe from a more practical, political way, I would say I would just find a way not to involve myself in that and stay in office.
Okay.
But that's shrewd politician speaking.
So, with three ideas of religion and government, do you believe that religious beliefs should be legally protected from ridicule?
No.
Tough one. Do you believe it is possible to prevent racial discrimination without giving religion special protection as well?
That's an interesting one.
Yes.
So, how would that manifest itself?
Muslims.
Okay.
We have Muslims or Jews form a very interesting, where you have sort of a cultural group as well as a religious group. And can you protect them from discrimination without somehow providing the religion that sort of identifies them as protection as well? It's okay. You don't have to answer them.
That's a tough one. But I would probably say, yes, you can separate the religion from the culture.
Okay. I think I would agree, too. But yeah. it becomes...
There's a gray area in there, I think. Yeah.
In Canada, not so many years ago, well, maybe decades ago, each morning in school, start off with a rendition of O Canada, God Save the Queen, and the Lord's Prayer. Do you think this should be restored to public schools in Canada?
No.
No on all three, or no on just some of them?
I guess you could sing O Canada if you wanted to, but the other two I have no particular desire to see returned.
Okay. Should cultural or religious courts, such as Aboriginal courts or Sharia courts, be recognized as alternative systems within the Canadian legal system?
No.
Okay. Religion and law. A licensed pharmacist who, on account of religion, chooses not to dispense a prescription drug to a customer should have their license revoked?
Yes.
Okay. A prison inmate should not be paroled or granted prison favors on account of their religious conversion.
That's right. They shouldn't be granted special treatment.
What about their religious deconversion?
Unfortunately, no, that shouldn't count either.
Okay. A religious leader who learns of a commission of a felony should be immune from prosecution for failure to report the crime.
I'm going to have to go with no on that one.
Okay. Do you think that abortion time limits should be always determined by the current scientific and medical consensus?
I'd say yes.
Parents who, on religious grounds, prevent or delay their children from receiving life-saving medical treatment should not be immune from persecution or loss of custody of their children.
So they should not be immune. I would say they should not be immune.
Okay. Do you believe that complementary and alternative medicine, CAM, for those of us who don't know, mm-hmm. and this would include things like naturopathy, chiropractic medicine, herbalism, biofeedback, hypnosis, homeopathy, and or acupuncture, should be given equal support in our public health system?
They should not.
Okay. Do you think unproven medical treatments, not alternative medicines, be funded by government? For example, there is this, the new treatment for multiple sclerosis where they kind of do...
Right. Yeah, it should not be funded into operation, but I don't have a problem with funding research into it.
Okay. Do you think that most societal problems are best solved with market solutions?
Wow. That's like a Daniel question.
Yep. Well, to be good skeptics, right? And I'm not saying, you know, you might think some of these are good answers and I might think some of these are bad answers, but the idea is to find out where do the politicians stand, right?
Right.
So some of these are obviously red flags for most skeptics or atheists, but some of them are just, well, where do you sit on this particular issue?
Yeah, I mean, that one would I'd probably be right in the middle of, I think.
Okay. A related one, and we probably would use one, not both, but do you think the best government is one that governs the least?
No.
Should a civil servant or independent government advisor whose views in their area of expertise that conflict with government policy be able to express those views publicly without fear of being fired?
Yes.
Unequivocally?
Absolutely.
Do you think a similar civil servant or independent government advisor who uses their position to express views they are not an expert in should be fired? For example, someone who is a space scientist commenting on whether fluoride in the water is a good thing and uses their position to make that claim.
If they're using their position, then I would say at very least grounds for review. I don't know if I should fire them, though.
Sure. Should policymakers trust scientific evidence even when it seems counterintuitive?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay. Aren't you worried that might make you a science dogmatist?
No, I'm not.
Okay. I also wanted to include some general knowledge questions into this, too. I think these for our listeners, are going to be really lowball ones. But I think at the same time, you'd be surprised at how many people would fall into this. So, for example, does the sun revolve around the Earth?
Let me think about that one for a while. I see it move across the sky. So, clearly...
20% of Americans think the sun goes around the Earth.
That's, you know.
Do you think the age of the Earth is closer to 6,000 years than 4 billion years?
I have to lean on the 4 billion side myself.
And do you believe in evolution?
I believe in it, absolutely. I have an altar to Charles Darwin in my basement that I routinely pray to.
Given a system under which parents direct public education funds to schools, with things like vouchers, which has become one of the things that we use for private schools and all that, that these schools can deny admission to children on account of religion of their children or their parents, should they still remain eligible for the public funding? So if a private school, mm-hmm. right, which has been given public funding, can it discriminate based on the religion of the child or the family?
Well, it depends on how much private funding has been given. Okay. If it's receiving any public funds, they should be bound to, you know, the public standards of education.
So on a scale of 1 to 5, where 1 is strongly agree and 5 is strongly disagree, you'd put yourself?
I guess strongly disagree.
Okay. In public school science classes, is it appropriate to teach alternatives to established scientific theories without regard to the extent to which these alternatives are supported by scientific evidence?
Well, if they're being taught to affirm real science, I don't have a problem with that. I have a problem with they're being taught as alternatives to science.
Okay. So you wouldn't believe in the teaching of creationism, except to show that creationist science is not really science.
That's right.
What about global warming debate?
Again, I have no problem teaching the debate in the sense that here's what you don't do, versus here's how science works. But when you're just sort of teaching it to be kind of, you know, an anti-science advocate, then I think you have a problem with that.
Now, this is one that I picked up from the Austin Skeptic Society, Austin, Texas Skeptic Society, mm-hmm. which struck me as weird, and I had to go through it a few times before I kind of understood, I think, where they were going for. But should public schools be allowed to provide appropriate warnings about religious laws and practices in foreign lands that could put the visitors' lives and liberties at risk? So, I know, I'm going, well, that would... It seems kind of a weird thing, but I think where this one was going for is the idea that, for example, if you're gay and you go to Uganda, there's a significant chance that you're going to get killed or at least arrested, mm-hmm. right? Now, that's sort of the positive aspect of it. Now, there's a negative aspect to it as well, is that if you're a Christian and you go to Saudi Arabia, you might get killed. And I'm not sure if those are co-equivalent, but the idea is that... that religious laws, right, in foreign lands can affect people. So when we say there should be no religion in schools, does that include this kind of information?
Well, this sounds less like more like common sense good advice. Don't go someplace or you will get killed. To me, regardless of the reason why you might get killed, just seems like a good advice.
Yeah, that's sort of the way I guess I had to go through it in my head a few times before I kind of, I think...
It's kind of a complex... perhaps they could have sort of made that question a bit more clear-cut.
I think I'm going to make a note to make that more clear-cut.
Yeah, it's a good idea.
So, public school teachers, including those in private schools that receive public funding, should never be required to respond to religious tests.
So what does that mean?
Essentially, should there be religious discrimination for teachers being hired at schools?
Any schools or just are religious schools?
Well, any schools, although any schools receiving public funding. It might be an overreach to say any school.
Well, there shouldn't be religious tests about a teacher's competence any time ever, so...
Okay.
Yeah.
So... The American Constitution... unlike the U.S. Constitution, there is no explicit separation of church and state. In fact, our Constitution states in the preamble that Canada is founded upon a principle that recognizes the supremacy of God and the rule of law. And I don't know where you're going to go on this one, but do you think that this should be removed from our Constitution?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you believe that tax-exempt status should only go to those groups who provide social services to the community, and that their exemption be proportional to both the services they provide and the extent of the community that they serve?
They should only apply to groups that do social work. I don't know about the second part of that question, though.
Okay. Because I think one of the things that come into that is when Daniel was on the show, and he did a thing about the Mormons, that, you know, the Mormons have a very exclusive second temple that only a very limited number of people. So they could claim that they are providing a service to the community, although an extremely limited and secluded number. So that's why I thought the second part was interesting. Those that employ charities should receive no special tax exemption or any non-standard... those who are employed for a charity should receive no special tax exemption, and any non-standard remuneration, such as free accommodation, should be treated like any other benefit. So if you're a priest, right, priests don't actually get paid a lot, but they get a lot of perks in the job, free accommodation, among other things, and all that. But because of their particular job title, they get exempted from taxes, or at least a large portion of taxes, because of these other perks. Do you think they should be treated any different than, let's say, perks that are offered to a CEO or your job when you were working somewhere?
Priests got free accommodations?
Well, they get to live in the rectory or the...
Oh, okay.
Like the church owns a house as well as the church, and often the priest gets to live in the church rent-free, right?
Oh, I see.
Which is a benefit, and if you were in a lot of other circumstances, you have to claim that as a benefit.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, I don't think they should get any kind of special powers. That seems unfair.
Okay. Do you... Sorry, Daniel. Do you believe it is better to cut services or raise taxes to balance a budget? Yeah, this should have been another area, but...
Yeah, that's more of an economic question that I don't really have the experience to properly analyze.
Do you think the tar sands is an environmental hazard or an economic jackpot?
Can it be both?
Ooh, good one. Do you believe in climate change?
Yeah, I believe the climate changes.
Do you believe it's caused by human actions?
Yeah, it can be. It can also be caused by natural causes, but yeah, so both.
Okay. Do you believe that immediate action is required to mitigate these potential damages or actual damages?
Yes.
And do you think that because of trouble with international coordination, that unilateral action should be taken on the part of Canada, even though there may require some economic adjustments?
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, okay, good.
Sad I do.
Good, good. I won't vote for you, but no, of course.
Okay. Well, that's really great. You know, and I think that this can be something that, you know, we can promote to the skeptical community to try to get the word out there to, you know, their MPs and their representatives to see, you know, who am I voting for? What do they really think about science?
Well, you know, and this plays into a really important thing, because a lot of other groups, largely religious groups, provide these kind of questionnaires to candidates, and the candidates use this because they live in a bubble, and the only way they know what the people are thinking about is largely due to these sort of interactions with them. And the only voice they hear are, you know, these other, what we would consider to be fringe groups. Politicians can get a very slanted view. So by creating this list of survey questions, and again, please give us your comments on radio.freethinker@gmail.com, by providing the survey, we're not only trying to figure out exactly what the candidates are thinking, but we're providing to the candidates what we are thinking. These are important issues to us. These are the things we want you to start talking about and moving on.
Absolutely. Well, we're out of time, so let's wrap up with our skeptical highlights. My first highlight here is the Imagine No Religion Conference, which is Saturday, May 7th in Kamloops, BC. This conference is presented by the Kamloops Center for Rational Thought and CFI Okanagan, and it will feature such speakers as PZ Myers, Brian Dalton, Jim McCrite, and Christopher DiCarlo. Check out ImagineNoReligionKamloops.com for all the details.
And I got one for the Philosopher's Cafe. It's What Makes a Good Teacher? Teachers can never forever poison a field of knowledge or an area of effort or skill or create a lifelong passion. So what exactly is the difference? What makes a good teacher? This is being held at the False Creek Community Center. That's 1318 Cartwright Street in Vancouver. Thursday, March 3rd from 7 to 9 p.m. There is an admission of $5. But philosophy, coffee, not quite as good as skepticism and beer, but getting close.
Absolutely. Well, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying eyes on, minds open.
Bye-bye, everybody.